Benjamin Britten's 1947 comic opera Albert Herring didn't please everybody the first time around, including the founder of the festival where it was first performed. On the other hand, the great pianist Sviatoslav Richter called it the best comic opera of the 20th century. Well, one thing is for sure, Albert Herring is the work of one of the great composers of the century when he was at the height of his powers. What does it take to bring it to the stage? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Our guests are William Florescu, the general director of the Florentine Opera in Milwaukee, which is performing Albert Herring March 8th through 17th, and Radel Rozell, who sings the part of the, well, for the most of the opera at least, all too virtuous Albert.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Glad to be here.
Let me start by saying I've never seen Albert Herring performed, so can you start by telling me what have I missed?
Well, I agree with Mr. Richter that it's one of the great comedies because while it has all the great archetypes of English characters in it, Britten being the great genius that he is, those archetypes are infused with real characters. So they're not just cutouts, they're real people. And the whole idea that Britten sort of focused on his whole life, the idea of the outsider and how that person fits into society, is dealt with perhaps for the only time in Britten's life in a comic way. And so Albert, as he makes the journey from innocence to a more open and knowing person, it's just done both dramatically and musically brilliantly.
It is interesting how often Britten used that theme, isn't it? When you think about Peter Grimes or even Billy Budd, based on an American theme in the latter case, he has that perspective of the outsider. And I wonder how much of that, well, actually, Albert Herring was supposed to be, to some extent, the character, a self-portrait of Britten.
Absolutely. I mean, if you read about Britten a lot, you know that he had a lifelong struggle between his loss of innocence and struggling with who he was as a human being and knowing more about the real world. And so I think of all of his characters, even more than Grimes or Billy Budd, Albert sort of represents who Britten is as a person. And I think that's why it works so incredibly well.
And he wrote that part for his other half, Peter Pears, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Lifelong partner who I was lucky enough to get to know and sing for when I was back in my performing days. So it's a double treat for me to get to be involved in this.
And Rodel, what does it feel like to be the title character of Albert Herring? And what is your understanding of sort of who you are and come to be in the course of this opera?
I've always mostly done character roles, and I think Albert Herring, the character itself, is one of the best character roles written for a tenor. I've done it once when I was in college, and it's really a pleasure and an adventure to actually sing it again on a broader stage. And I'm excited to actually explore more of the character. I've known a little about it when I was in college and now exploring it again. And I think it's just a lot of – I consider it a coming-of-age opera.
It certainly
and
is that.
It is. And it's, you know, from the development of the character – from someone going timid to actually exploring life outside, and that's what I'm looking forward to. I'm excited.
Can you give us the plot and the whole business about the May Queen problem?
Sure. You know, and even though this is an early 20th century British plot, it's something that I think resonates so well today. It's basically the protagonists of the opera, people you never see, and that's the young women whose characters are assassinated at the beginning, that they're deemed not worthy of being the May Queen. They need to find somebody innocent. If you've as much as shown an ankle in public, you're not worthy. So they find this young sort of flummoxed boy to be the May Queen. And so the first thing that happens, we see these intolerant townspeople who then pick this boy to be May King, and then the characters around that, and they can't leave that innocence alone. They have to, in some way, warp it in terms of whether through rum or the expectations that they put upon him. And so the journey that we see that he makes, evidenced by how they're moved by these characters and how he makes the journey to wise at the end, I think is pretty amazing. And it's in good fun, but in some ways, for me, it's his deepest piece, because comedy and sometimes makes these real human emotions more real than tragedy, at least for me.
Well, let's get a little into the choosing of the May King and hear how Britten treats that.
Absolutely.
The first suggestion on my list is a charming local girl who takes communion and never missed a Sunday. Jennifer Searle
had an affair with young Tom O'Dell last Christmas. Case dismissed. Of all the pupils from the school, it gives me particular pleasure to recommend Elizabeth Newell, whose botany notes are a treasure. Was seen in the woods after dusk with a moon in a rustling roof, not good.
There's Winifred Brown, who works in the town as assistant to Mrs. Bell. I've asked about her, and people concur she behaves on the average quite well.
Except she went with her cousin from Kent for a trip in a go-kart one Sunday in Lent. Speak up, Bud!
I've little to say, lady, so I'll make it short and sweet. The girl in my mind is a treasure you'll find. Her name is Amelia Keith.
Exposes her ankles and legs bold as brass. The skirts were too short for a girl of her class. None of this what is the feel of the mean?
It's rather amusing to think this was originally a story by Guy de Maupassant, you know.
Exactly.
And I can't even imagine the French having the same issues choosing a May Queen that the English would.
Not at all.
But it's a little bit like Gilbert and Sullivan at times in this part.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that characters on this recording have done a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan, but I think that you see Britain's connection to that, but you also see the majority of that scene is accompanied only by piano.
Yes.
And the conductor is going to be doing that for our production as well. So it also, I think, shows Britain's homage and love for the Baroque and classical periods. You know, he was a great conductor of the Bach Passions, for instance. And I think you see that recitative and arioso style that really, I think, is inspired from the Baroque era. And it's a really good example of it here.
Is some of the humor coming from the fact that they're singing so seriously and operatically about something as simple as, you know, showing your ankles or something having to do with a greengrocer and all, you know, later on and so on? I mean, is some of the humor, the incongruity between opera itself and then the subject matter?
I think the grand gesture toward the minuscule, I think, is a perfect way of describing that. And I think that the more you see these archetypes of these very busybody town types, they're the ones that do that, whereas Albert and Sid and Nancy, the couple that he's connected with throughout, are much more humanistic and have much more, I would say, spoken-like quality to some of their music because it's much more humanistic and not gesturing or posturing. And I think Britain does a beautiful job of differentiating those things.
Ah, but Albert's mother.
Well, yes.
How do you play her? Because isn't she really the problem here?
She is. She's aspirational in all the wrong ways. She wants to hold him down while simultaneously acquiescing to everything that the powers that be are. She's that person who has contempt from where she comes from and contempt for the bigger powers but doesn't know how to navigate those things. And she, in some ways, she is the crux of the story. I don't know how you feel about that, having done that. But.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Albert's character, he's, you know, he's never really gone out and, you know, he's perfectly fine, just fine with just being at home doing some work. So the only person that he really trusts is his mother. Because it's, you know, if you notice, there's no father. So the mother is in charge of him, like grew up with just one parent, I would only guess. I mean, and he trusts her. So if she says, you know, this is right, this is wrong, you know, there's no one else for him to ask advice on except for a few people who visit. But, you know, like personally for me, I'm kind of like very close to my mom. So there's that connection. But at the same time, you know, how far would that go? You know, once you hit a certain age, you can't just, oh, you know, that's why he becomes very curious.
Yes, but, more than just a mom's boy.
Exactly.
Yeah. We've been in a rather Victorian or Edwardian way tippy-toeing around the V word. And that is to be the May Queen, you have to be a virgin.
Right.
And to be none of those candidates qualify. pretty clearly, at least by implication, and the only one suitable is then Albert, who has been, just as you say, living at home with mom.
I think so much intolerance comes, and there's a better definition for what I'm going to say, but a lot of intolerance comes from the suspicion that somebody's having more fun than you are. and I think that's what these townspeople are all about. And so they want to find the one person who they suspect is more miserable than they are. But to Rodell's point, I think he's perfectly happy in the world that he lives until he's sort of yanked unceremoniously out of it. And I think that that's a real interesting psychology of the piece in that regard.
I think it's, you know, when it comes to being, you know, virtuous or a virgin, think about it is every single young person in the story, they, for some reason, all the people involved in picking the May Queen, whether it's a girl or a boy, they have some gossip. But right. The only person they don't have any gossip on is Albert Herring because he stays at home the whole time. So they found the idea, why not having a making? So yeah. It's perfect. But since like what Bill said, Albert is so used to being at home. He doesn't know what the outside is. So he's caught off guard and really surprised. Like in the opera, he says, I'm not going to do what they tell me to do. Because for him, they're strangers. Mm-hmm. He will, even though the mom is saying, but I'm telling you to do this, but it didn't really come from the mother. The mother was told, you need to do this. We want Albert to do this. So for him, for some reason, it actually shows how he's growing up. It's like, wait, you're telling me to do this, but you didn't come up with that idea. Somebody mm-hmm. told you to do this. So I'm not doing it. So that's how the conflict begins for him.
So he's certainly been very sheltered.
Yes.
What are you doing visually on stage? In other words, what are you going to be wearing when we see you at the beginning, when you are this innocent Albert?
See anything yet?
We haven't started yet. But we went with a more mid-century look than when he actually said it, simply because so many of those archetypes, actually, they exist even today. He'll be in an apron and hauling in a big sack of dry goods for the store that he works in. And so he looks like a very sort of innocent young kid doing his work. There are shades of white in all of this because you sort of knock people over the head with the innocence and the purity of white and all of that. But we're not avoiding that as a marker, let's put it that way. Yeah.
You have this scene with the kids in the shop. What's going on with that?
This is sort of sets up everything. And I think Britain, you know, Britain had a lifelong love and interest in children in terms of what he did musically with the Ceremony of Carols and the Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra.
True.
And he wrote some really sophisticated music for the kids and introduced them and the struggle that the kids have with the adults. And he wrote music that's at once very sophisticated but sounds simple. And it's been really great. We've already had music rehearsals with our young kids who are playing the parts. And it really sets up that world of innocence because we haven't met Albert yet when we see the kids in the shop. And the innocent world that he lives in, I think, is set up and introduced by these kids. And I just think the music gives us a good idea of what that's about.
Thank you.
can hear Benjamin Britten, the great composer of instrumental music, and they're using all the different qualities of instruments, too.
Well, you know, what's fascinating about this piece in that regard is that there are 13 characters and there are 13 instruments in the orchestra.
Talking about balance.
And very often, certain instruments represent, they don't always stay consistent, but, you know, you have the bassoon with the superintendent of the police, you have the higher wind instruments with the kids and things like that. It's really beautifully done. And as you can tell in that scene, very often the instruments don't get in the way of the voices. They actually sometimes comment on what the voices are doing. Like I said, it's just brilliantly orchestrated.
It was an interesting combination of, I guess, experiences. Britten was actually influenced by Aaron Copland when he was in this country right during the war in Europe before this country had gotten into it. And he was, I think, had been influenced a little bit by Billy the Kid, for example, in the scores of Copland. But at the same time, he had already, by this time, let's say 1941, written his opera Paul Bunyan.
Right.
So, and he was writing for film music as well as what you'd call straight, you know, classical music. It just shows how eclectic Britten is.
Well, and you can argue that his magnum opus, Peter Grimes, was only 2 years previous to this, 1945.
Right.
But what he did, I think, so incredibly well was go back and forth between types of forces that he wrote for and approached. And it's just the sometimes craft is a slap in the face when we're talking about the arts. But I think Britten really uses craft in such a way to make the pieces he worked dramatically. And I think that's why he's the great opera composer of the 20th century.
And it's his 100th birthday this year.
Yes, that's not coincidental that we're doing that for this. We wanted to celebrate it.
More on the opera, Albert Herring, when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
Everybody getting excited about the bestowing of the honor of May King on Albert Herring during the opera by the same name, written in 1947 by Benjamin Britten, and it's being produced by Milwaukee's Florentine Opera March 8th through the 17th. And we're finding out about it from behind the scenes in the production of Albert Herring. That scene also, well, it's a comic opera, needless to say. And again, it's kind of the overinflated approach. And what better possibility to overinflate than when you're talking about Britten in the first decade of the 20th century, which is when this opera is set. You have these big women voices.
Right, right. And the women who get to play this role, you know, they're usually the people who are doing the big Wagnerian roles or big Verdi roles,
uh-huh.
and very often don't get to do the type of character stuff that Rodel gets to do on a regular basis. So they tend to, like, chew the stage in anything that's within spitting distance because they don't get to do that often. So it's really a part that women sopranos of this type really relish playing because it's so much fun. And this whole scene, she gets very confused because she loses her papers and it gets... It just gets increasingly funny, and it's a great scene as Albert sits there bewildered, not having any idea why they're giving him all this stuff. It's really fantastic.
And how is Britten playing around with gender here, with men and women? I mean, he's doing this. There's no May Queen, so let's have a May King. What is he suggesting, kind of, about men and women in this opera?
It's easy to sort of retrofit things today, but I mean, there's no doubt that Britten's own struggles with homosexuality, which through most of his life wasn't even legal in Britten, and what that meant. To my mind, there's no doubt that it's commenting on it, but I've done a lot of research on it. I don't know exactly what it means. I just know that the role playing and what it means for male and female roles in society is being addressed with this, certainly. And he was probably taking it as far as he could within the context of where he was living, you know, and I think that played a big part in it.
You know, in traditionally, when they're thinking about purity, kindness, they're all just good qualities and softness. Traditionally, people always go to, oh, those are feminine qualities. And I think this is a good way of Britain showing that, you know what, men have those qualities too, but they're never being considered because in the traditional world, it's all masculine and strong. There's no sense of softness. And by doing this, it's very cool how Britain introduced this by using Albert. Oh, there are people like Albert who are innocent. They're male, but they have the same qualities as women would have. And it's also interesting how even though Lady Billows, she's a very strong woman. So she shows a lot of what you call traditional masculine power. And the total opposite would be Albert, for someone who's so innocent to show some kind of softness to his actions. So it's a good way of Britain to show that, you know, the equality during that time, but then a little bit under.
Yeah, and turning it upside down. Yeah. What about class? Britain suggests anything here in terms of class structure?
Well, you know, Britain, there's a little bit of mum in Britain, too, because Britain was very happy late in his life to accept the title of Lord Britain. And whereas somebody like Vaughan Williams, for instance, would never accept that type of thing because he was much more of had much more problem with the idea of class. So I think Britain was somewhat aspirational in that.
But he turned down a knighthood.
Yeah,
for the sake of having this, I guess, lesser.
Yeah, it's odd, but I think just the conflict of what Britain saw there. But I think there's no doubt that he shows more humanity in the characters that are quote-unquote lower class than the people that are upper class. But I don't think he ever rejected things. I mean, he very happily wrote things for the Catholic Church, for the Church of England, and all of that. So he had a real interesting – it was a very complex relationship with society at large.
How do you convey or produce action for a plot like this? I mean, on the face of it, it sounds like it's a story about committees and things that haven't happened. So in terms of action on stage, what do we get?
Staging opera is not easy, but Britain really helps you a lot with what, you know, some of the instrumental licks that you heard in the kids scene, for instance, the staging is actually given to you. And he has that in common with Mozart as well, that the staging is there. So that, for instance, the banquet scene, the way you have to lay it out really makes the staging happen the way it needs to happen. The places where I think it's more difficult is when Albert is having sort of his own psychological struggle with himself. And he has to take the stage. And that's really the burden then really falls on the actor. And Rodel's such a fantastic actor. I think it'll work really well. But the big crowd scenes are really laid out very well to make those things happen. It's those more intimate moments where a person's struggling with himself that I think are more difficult.
That's tough. So as this banquet scene, if we come back to it, what will we see?
Well, you imagine a table laid out. And just like the painting of The Last Supper, you have to arrange it in a way that you wouldn't in real life, which is everybody on one side of the table. But again, each of these archetypes get up and make their gift to Albert. And there's some real, you know, like Miss Wordsworth gives him the two volumes of Fox's Book of Martyrs, which is a real book, interestingly enough, which I've looked at.
Yeah, pretty grim, too.
Exactly. But the subtext here is that the vicar has the hots, if I can put it that way, for Miss Wordsworth. And so you see this giving this Book of Martyrs while simultaneously you see this subplot with the two of them. So as each character stands up, you see that expressed. And all they really have to do by standing up, Britain writes this music that says everything about their character. The mayor is very sort of hyper and chirps away. Miss Wordsworth goes off on flights of fancy. And Bud is sort of very blunt and harumph, like a blunt village policeman would be. So again, the most I can probably do is screw it up. And a lot of these, it's getting out of the way of it to really make it happen. It's a brilliant scene.
The banquet scene.
I'm full of happiness to be here in your midst. I'm so
That in addition to these large crowd scenes and where a lot of people are singing and so on, that there are also internal ones. Can you say something about the monologue that Albert has after the banquet?
I think this is one of Britain's most brilliant creations. We go out of this big festive scene, and we know that Albert is completely sort of flummoxed by what's happening to him. And so then we go to this very, we go back to the greengrocer shop. It's very bare, and we have Albert sort of pondering what's just happened to him. And, you know, Rodel's done the role before, so I mean, it's just a fascinating scene, and it's really a great monologue within a comedy that's not comic at all. It's very heartfelt, and you see this character struggling with what's happening here. And I think it's one of the great scenes in the opera. It's really fantastic.
What do you say, Rodel, in this scene?
I love this monologue, which is, you know, it's always excerpted by singers, you know, for auditions and some competitions, because it not only shows off voice, which comes in and out. It's perfect combination of voice and character. Especially in the very beginning, we see Albert's like fun side. You know, he talks about coming home. Where's my mother? It's like, oh, look. What if I do with the matches? Oh, let me tell you. He's thinking about all these stuff that happened in the banquet, how much food he ate. And then suddenly talks about Nancy. It's like, And then it becomes melancholy. And then talks about Sid. Comes in and out. It shows how much of a kid he is, even though he's growing up, because he's only lived and with his mom. It's just the fun side. And that even as he portrays a boy who has fun, who is growing up, who shows that, you know, he may be young, but he is growing up. And we see that he does have that serious part of him that he needs to be treated as an adult, even though he may be thought of as someone who's innocent. Later on, he realizes that, you know, he's not going to settle for people just telling him what to do. He needs to take matters to his own hands and starts exploring outside of the house without anyone's supervision. And that's what's so cool about it. You start, you know, from, you know, a kid who just, you know, had so many toys and suddenly realizes, wonder where these toys are made from. It's like, oh, look at these. Oh, food. I wonder where they serve food. What kind of drinks do they, you know, all these why. Oh, but why? But why? And he actually takes it upon himself to actually explore without everyone's knowledge.
Is it kind of a luxury to do an English language opera?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, certainly. I love working in all languages, but there's something about exploring the subtlety of your own language, even though, the joke, we're two countries separated by a common language. There's a little bit of that with this, with the English text. But no, it's great because you can really dig into it in a way that I think only native speakers can do.
Do you still feel the desire to do super text, and do you do that with your other productions?
We do in the big hall, but in this hall we don't. We've had good success without doing it, because we're doing it in a 475-seat hall, which is really the type of space it should be in. So
is it called a chamber opera?
Yes.
So there's 13 instruments, 13 players, and pretty small ensemble.
Let's hear a little bit of Albert's monologue after the banquet.
Little Albert, your sugar plum of a prodigal son. in the whistle, sound as a drum from his coronation.
Listening to that, we were, you know, delving into what's going on there, and we didn't mention going into it that the character, Albert Herring, is pickled when he is singing this monologue.
Well done.
Is that unusual? Are there I guess there are some drunken arias in opera.
Sure. Hamlet's aria in Tomas Hamlet, the Van Discipula Tristessa, you could argue that Iago, when he does the Beva con me scene in Otello, Pericles aria, when she's the tipsy waltz in La Pericle. So.
Got to wonder about some of the drinking songs, too, of course.
That's right. That's right.
But you used the term, Adele, of ADD during, during this aria.
I don't really know how much ADD when people drink, how much ADD they have. I think they do. I mean, I've been to bars, so I know that, when you drink, you say hi to someone, then you see someone you know, you move immediately to them and then ask them how they are. And in this scene, Albert, he comes in thinking that his mom is there and then it's not, and then remembers, oh yeah, that's the reason why my mom's there. Oh look, matches. Maybe I could play with it. Oh yeah, that was a great party. We ate this. Oh yeah, Nancy. It's like, oh, why was she looking at me? It's funny. It's like drunk. Hopefully this does not happen in real life, but it would be like a perfect example if, you know, a teenager would get drunk. I mean, this is like ADD calmness. He's calm, but then giddy at the same time.
We have to explain how this nice guy, who's the only suitable person in town to be the May Queen, or in this case, King, got drunk in the first place, though.
Right. Well, there's two characters, and Sid and Nancy are a subplot. But they're the couple in town, and there's some indication that Albert is sort of sweet on Nancy as well. But Sid's the butcher's assistant, and he's the very confident. He's the antithesis of Albert. He's a worldly guy, and he thinks it would be fun since this innocent kid is being sort of paraded. He's actually, in an odd way, defending Albert that he's being paraded around. So he decides to spike the lemonade with rum, and of course, Albert, having never had it, it doesn't take very much to send him over the edge. And so after he gets hiccups and they try to cure that, but then he's left to go home and sort of be spinning around because he's gotten drunk for the first time.
Well, and the music is fun to listen to because it goes from very soft and mellow to kind of exploding and all over the place as Albert's character gets revealed. You get the sense of Albert feeling like an outsider when he's watching Sid and Nancy.
Right.
You know, the way if you don't have a partner and then you have to see all these Valentine's couples and et cetera. Can you say something about Sid and Nancy's relationship with each other?
I was very lucky to work with someone who had worked with Nancy Evans, who created the role of Nancy. And what's really wonderful about, because the love duet music in this opera is very sincere. And it's really reflective of the fact that Nancy Evans, who created the role of Nancy, was in the beginnings of a love affair with Eric Crozier, who was the librettist. And so that love music is really a fusion of the words that Crozier wrote that expressed what he felt for Nancy Evans and for what Britain's feelings were toward Piers. So there's a luminosity and graciousness to the love music. So that even though I think Britain may have steered a little off course, because you really don't ever not like Sid, because there's such sincerity in the love music. And I'm not sure if he intended that or it was just a byproduct of the love that both of these creators were feeling toward their partners who were involved in the project as well. Regardless, and I did Sid myself, so I'm a little bit prejudiced about it, but it's really sincere music. So it's hard sometimes to then steer Sid back into being not a sympathetic, completely sympathetic character.
So what are we going to hear in this duet with Sid and Nancy?
Well, they meet outside. It's dark at night, and Nancy's quasi-upset that Sid's making a racket, but they talk about how they're going to get away and be together, and it's a classic love duet, high ups in town. It's got a real commonplace, in the best sense of the word, quality to it. It's really beautiful music.
Sounds like Sid serenading under a window, impatient at waiting, impatiently aching, to the Ignazi chasing love and adventure. By directness, simplicity, aims at his target with shameless audacity, trades on the fact of his ruthless veracity.
You oughtn't to listen. I told you about Sid.
It's perishing cold standing here in the street. 25 minutes. I'm frozen stiff.
I slipped down the stairs as quick as I could.
Let's call the pub for a couple of pours.
Sid, we mustn't.
Warm us up. Quick.
Oh no, people will talk.
Save enough food for chattering Albert tonight, so us two won't matter.
Poor kid, it does seem wrong to show him off to everyone like a sort of plaster saint or the village simpleton.
Oh, he's all right. Once he's sown a few wild oats, he'll live that down.
But how can he sow them tied to his bum?
I've done my share of providing the rum. Are you volunteering to cheer him? Along the agreement, a bumble primrose tart.
I don't know if you'd call them foils exactly for Albert Herring, but Sid and Nancy, kind of, in his way of thinking, I suppose, the ideal couple for a little while there.
Right.
We'll look further at Benjamin Britten's opera Albert Herring right after this when we return for University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are William Floresco and Rodel Rozell from the Florentine Opera in Milwaukee, and they are presenting the opera Albert Herring starting March 8th in Milwaukee, a comic opera about a greengrocer who loses his innocence and becomes May-king, gets drunk, and then disappears, right?
Right. It's he goes off on he decides he's going to go off on a jaunt. And of course, since nobody he's now shattered everybody's expectations of his, who he is. And so, of course, they jump to the immediate conclusion that he must, of course, died because one of the kids finds something in the pond that they think might be his body and all of that. And so instead of thinking that he might have the wherewithal just to say, look, I'm chucking all this and going to find out what the world's about, they assume he has to be dead. It says a lot about what their expectations are. It's comic, but it also gives Britain an opportunity to use his more serious side to layer against the comedy. So you have this very well-written serious music that happens, which is a counterpoint to the comic situation that's really at hand, and it's very, very effective. I mean, it's great that Britain has those tools at his hand to make that work like that.
It sounds like a section from a mass or something.
Exactly.
Threnody.
Right.
Threnody in the midst of life is death.
Well, that says it all. I mean, we were just talking, you know, that could be out of his war record. I mean, it's so beautifully written. If it weren't in the middle of Albert Herring, you'd say this is a gorgeous, real dirge. But because the audience is let in and knows that isn't the case, it becomes very, very funny. I think it's brilliant. I know I'm saying that a lot about this piece. But I truly
feel like this.
Yes. I do a bit. Yes.
Comedies often end with a marriage, but how is the plot going to somehow resolve the question of Albert here? How is it going to end?
You can say how you feel as the character.
Does Albert ever come out of it?
Let's just say there's a resolution. There's progress and resolution by the end of the opera. That's the. I mean, you know, they have to come and see it to actually
sure.
see what happens. But there is progress and resolution. But how it resolves and what kind of progress they make and what the characters, you know, how the characters respond. That's something for the people to know. Like,
So we had a cliffhanger here.
Yeah,
what happens to Albert?
Yeah,
does he come back? And how does he get along with his mother? And what's different about him?
Exactly.
Well, you know, some of the great operas, comedies in particular. For instance, at the end of Marriage of Figaro. I don't think anyone believes, even though the Count has this beautiful forgiveness scene, I think you know the next day things go bad again. In this one, Albert's free, but you don't know what that freedom and what that knowledge, since he's bitten of the apple, whether that bodes well or bodes badly. And I think that's a fabulous question that's asked, but I don't think resolved.
Yes, that's true. I can see various possibilities had Britain written a sequel.
That's right.
What do you hope that people who come to see Albert Herring will go out of the theater feeling and thinking?
Well, I think like all great comedies, I think that it hopefully will let them ponder the human condition and what it means. The human comedy, like Dante, you know, that we're sort of all in this together. And the constructs that we set up are really houses of cards. And the best comedies lay that bare, I think. And I think Britain does this. And the fact that it's set in Britain at a time separate than ours I think the truths that are there smack us in the face with the same reality that we see things every day here. I mean, I think it – hopefully that's what people take away from it.
You know, opera has a reputation for being serious and grand and you know – If people talk about musical theater, you know, there are also dramatic, very sad musical theater pieces. But, you know, most of musical theater in Broadway and even the touring companies, they have all this humor infused in them. And I think people should watch this opera because this is an opera where really there is great balance on both the musical part of it and the writing, even the incidental music, the use of music that you would sometimes hear in, you know, watching cartoons, the use of that. And those are the kind of things that would attract people. And I think people should really come and see this. So they know that there are operas that – there's not a lot of operas that really give this kind of comedy with drama and passion. You know, it's like a passionate comedy. I mean, this is what I think it is. And there's a moral lesson. There's, you know, like I said earlier, it's a coming of age. People could really, you know, really, you know, relate to this. And that's what the draw for this opera is. It's a comedy. It's a comic opera that – could be in line with any other non-operatic piece out there. And I'm really excited to do this and really show it. And then it's up to us performers to actually do a really good job.
Well, without tipping the results, what happens to Albert and Company, let's savor a little bit of the end of the opera, Albert Herring.
I didn't lay it on too thick.
Hi, that's my girl.
Charming finale for what sounds like a very charming opera, Albert Herring, a comic chamber opera by Benjamin Britten, which is being produced by the Florentine Opera in Milwaukee, March 8th through the 17th. And our recordings, by the way, have come from a production by the Northern Sinfonia with Stuart Bedford conducting, but we've had with us today the general director of the Florentine Opera, William Florescu, and the title role player, which would be Rodel Rozell as Albert. Thanks for joining us.
It's been our pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Our engineer has been Brittany True, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.